You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the National League West. I am Allison Fritter from MLB.com, and the hot stove season gets underway just about as soon as the last out of the World Series is made. So we are fully into that right now, and as we head to the winter meetings, we're keeping our eye on a lot of different teams, some that don't need to do a whole lot, like the Los Angeles Dodgers, and there's some that even, you know, the World Series winning San Francisco Giants, just all of a sudden they have all kinds of pitching questions, so that's something to keep an outlook on. And then, of course, some of the non-contenders, like the Diamondbacks and the Rockies seem to be on the mend. They need a lot of things to go right just from an injury standpoint in order to jump back in this thing. So it'll be an interesting thing to look at, and we will keep our eyes on it as the months go on and spring training approaches. I am joined by my colleague Ken Gernick, who covers the Dodgers for MLB.com. And as is per usual, when it comes to the Dodgers, there is never a dull moment. So let's get right to it. New general manager, Farhan Zaidi. So, Ken, tell me a little bit about this guy. I mean, everything I've read, people just have been pouring out these accolades for him with the A's for 10 years and joining seems to be sort of a front office dream team, and at least that's how it's kind of been written. So what's your take on this, and what do you think he's going to do for the whole dynamic with the Dodgers?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you told me about him because we haven't met him yet, but he's not an unknown. He's spent a decade up in Oakland. Last year as an assistant general manager, he's obviously very bright. Dodgers, that's a common theme now with Stan Kasten in charge. He's hiring people that not only know the game, but they know a lot of other things besides the game. So you've got him coming in as general manager, but don't overlook the fact that Josh Burns is coming in. And it really hasn't been spelled out yet as far as who's going to be reporting to who and who has certain responsibilities. But I would think Josh Burns, having been a two-time former general manager, is going to be very influential in this organization. So they're sort of collecting general managers. They've got four or five of them on the payroll now with Jerry Hunsicker and Ed Coletti and Burns and Friedman and now Zaidi. So they've got this dream team, or they're in the final parts of forming it, and I know one of the things that they really want to do, the fans are focused for obvious reasons on getting to the World Series and winning it, but this is an organization that needs to be rebuilt through its player development system, and Stan Kasten has talked a lot about that he doesn't want to be signing $200 million contracts all the time. He wants to be developing players through the system, so I think there's going to be a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes that you might not see out at Dodger Stadium immediately, but eventually you will.
The Dodgers that new ownership group came in and they brought in so many, you know, big contract guys. They signed guys to big contracts, and it really just made a huge splash. But, you know, when you say that they want to be really concentrating on player development, would you say that relatively a new revelation for them with this new group that they brought in, or do you think that they're just kind of staying the course?
No, it's really what Stan Kasten said when the new ownership took over 2.5 years ago, and that was they were going to improve the roster immediately to be competitive right now. But at the same time, they didn't want to remain in this kind of chasing their tail situation where every year they're filling holes by spending a ton of money on expensive free agents that you're really paying for what they've done in the past, not what they're going to do in the future. And so you have Stan Kasten, who spent time with Atlanta, with the Braves, and with the Nationals, both organizations known for developing players through their system. And he said all along that even though they're spending a lot of money on ready-made ball players now, that their goal was so that they wouldn't have to continue that. That's what was said in the beginning, but I guess you just couldn't do it all at once. So they focused on the major league roster for the first couple years, and now they've cleaned house upstairs with what seems to be an emphasis on trying to bolster that player development system so that they draft the right players, they develop them right, and they're able to promote them and fill the holes that they've had to fill through free agency so much in the last few years.
Do you think that they appreciate the significance or what it can do to a team if you draft and develop your own players and then they win together on the major league level? I mean, it just seems like, I mean, just looking at the playoff team this year, I mean, so many of these teams had, you know, like 18 guys on the Cardinals roster were drafted and developed by the Cardinals. And then you looked at the Royals, who obviously had drafted their own players. I mean, do you think that the Dodgers like can appreciate that? And kind of, do you think that they understand the importance of that kind of dynamic? And I say that because, I mean, just as an outside observer, with you know, just having covered the Dodgers in the first round, and you know, you sort of hear things like, you know, this group of really talented guys making a ton of money, and they're just, it's sort of a fractured group. Though there's not like some continuity inside the clubhouse. You know, do you agree with that?
Well, I think you have to step back and take a look at a bigger picture here. You're talking about an organization that only 4 or 5 years ago was in bankruptcy. I mean, they were badly mismanaged. They had an ownership group that wasn't focused on winning, and they robbed Peter to pay Paul, you know, in certain ways. And the net result was they abandoned the Caribbean. They didn't sign or draft the right players, you know, in certain instances. And so their farm system was shredded, and now you have new ownership coming in, but you don't turn that around on a dime. You can spend $200 million and turn your major league roster over overnight, but you can't do that in a farm system. That takes that's a five-year program to get players drafted and develop them. And so here we are now going into the fourth season under this ownership group, and you see that they're now addressing what they feel is the way to do this, and that's by creating a new front office filled with young, talented, bright people that have been known in the past working with the Red Sox, working with the A's and the Indians, and they have, and of course Tampa Bay with Andrew Friedman, and they all are approaching this from a background of getting the most for their money. Even though the Dodgers seem to have endless supply of money, the people that they've brought in have all been kind of trained on how to do it on the cheap and get the maximum bang for the buck. And that almost always is done by developing your own players. So it's what Stan Kasten said when the new ownership took over, and it's something that I think he's wanted to do, but they had other immediate priorities that they had to address to keep the fan base satisfied. And now I just think this is another phase of what they felt was a total turnaround project and just something that you can't do all at once.
Yeah, I think that they have the right idea, certainly, with the amount of talent that they're certainly collecting in the front office. Moving on to some of the on-field situations, so you've got the qualifying offer out to Hanley Ramirez. I feel like every time I talk to you, we focus on Hanley Ramirez, but he is a fascinating figure. So it kind of makes sense for the Dodgers to offer it. Probably doesn't make sense for Hanley to accept it. If you leave, what's next? You had thrown out some options there as to how that can sort of shape up. Do you think that Hanley would accept this offer?
No, I don't. I think that he probably figures that he can do better than a one-year deal of $15.3 million. Even with the warts in his game, he's still an impact bat. So I'd be surprised if he doesn't find somebody out there willing to better that offer and keep him out there. You know, I think the Dodgers would love to keep his bat, but they really don't have a place to play him. So they're kind of torn on that. They definitely don't want to sign him long-term because they got Corey Seager kind of a year or two away in the minor leagues, and they figure he's going to be an impact shortstop. So they know Hanley really isn't a shortstop anymore. At third base, you know, the jury's out on how well he would be over there. You know, he really has become more of an American League player. And I think if he were to accept an American League role and DH, he probably could keep his body together longer and stay on the field better. So, you know, the signs really point for him not to return to the Dodgers. But I'm sure they would take him back, obviously. Or they wouldn't have made this offer should he accept it for a one-year deal. They just never really were interested in signing him for a long-term deal.
when you look at the Dodgers, what they need to concentrate on, figuring out who their setup man is, finding a fifth starter, and those are always typically the needs of a team that doesn't really have to do a whole lot in the offseason. Some of the other teams you talk to, it's like, well, they need at least two starting pitchers. They have to get all these guys back from the disabled list, blah blah blah. But with the Dodgers, I mean, it's pretty, it's very minimal, I guess, the amount of tweaks that they really have to make. But the bullpen, I would imagine, is something that they're really going to have to concentrate on.
Right. You know, there's a lot of criticism that Ned Coletti hasn't gotten him into the World Series, but this team under his direction has won back-to-back division titles. So it's not like Andrew Friedman is inheriting, a total mess here. The roster, right. They've got a winning roster. They've got star players. They've got Gold Glove winners and probably a Cy Young winner and maybe an MVP winner. So this isn't a bad team right now. It's a good team. It's one of the better teams in baseball. So they do have to stabilize shortstop. They got to figure out what will happen there, and they can get moving on that after Monday when they know for sure that Hanley hasn't accepted it. And the bullpen is a problem. They've spent a lot of money down there, but they do need somebody for that eighth inning. But again, this is not a team that has got a lot of holes. They really only have a handful of items that they really need to deal with.
I love the way you ended your sort of hot stove preview by saying the bottom line is how long will it take for Friedman to wonder just what he's got himself into, which I found very humorous. But it's also, there's a lot of truth to it, too, because, like you said, at a gigantic payroll, you've got like four or five general managers and just a whole lot of owners that want a lot of answers. So he says work cut out for him. So, Ken, thank you. We will check back with you in a couple weeks. Appreciate it. I am here with Chris Hest, who mercilessly covered this team, this World Series winning team, from start to finish for our lovely website, MLB.com. So now that the World Series is over and it's been about a week, and now that the parades are done and everyone's back hunkered down in their offices, we can move on to the hot snow season, which is always a fun time for the fans. And Chris, thanks for waking up long enough to talk to us. So the big question, I guess we'll start with Pablo Sandoval, because that's what everyone's talking about. So he's a free agent to be. I was shocked to see he's only 28 years old. I feel like he's just been around forever. And he's looking to cash in, and, well, can you blame him? I mean, he's having a pretty nice career. He had an outstanding postseason, so he put himself in a good position. What do you think? What do you think about his chances to stay with the Giants? He's going to test the free agent market. There's going to be, I think, a lot of suitors for him.
Yes, Allison, definitely. You know, he profiles not only as a third baseman, but you could see him filling a DH role in the American League. So I think of more than a few American League clubs would be interested in him too, although he was a finalist for the Rawlings Gold Glove Award at third base. I could be wrong on this, and this is not based on any conversations I've had with anybody, but I think it actually might happen quick with him. Maybe not necessarily this week or the next week, but I would not be surprised to be signed before the winter meetings, because I think somebody's just going to throw a ton of dough at him and make him an offer he can't refuse. Precisely because of what you said, there are a lot of suitors for him, and I think whoever signs him will realize that they're going to have to whip out the big bucks.
It's funny because I loved his quote. I'm going to go where my heart tells me, which is, I love the guy. And I mean, he's great. He's great for the fans. He's a great teammate. I'm sure he wants to stay in San Francisco. I mean, right now he's coming off the high of winning a World Series with them. But I'm going to go where my heart tells me is funny to me, because he's going to go where the dollar signs tell him to go, and where his agent advises him to go. But, it's usually, even when guys like feel that tug to their hometown team, sometimes that dissipates when you really start getting down to dollars and cents. So, do you think that you hear about the hometown discounts that, pretty much never work out, but do you think that there's a good chance that he would want, like, maybe that he would take a little bit less to stay in San Francisco?
Maybe a little bit less, Allison, all things considered. I think a lot of it's going to have to depend on, timing, the mechanics. Let's say the Giants come in one day, and another team comes in about roughly the same day, or one day previous offering, maybe just a few few. It's tough to talk and not to hold to keep a straight face. You know, maybe offering just a couple million more or whatever than the Giants. Then maybe that hometown discount kicks in. When he was asked point blank, we reporters who cover the team caught up with him, between sessions at the parade last Friday, and he. When he was asked about the hometown discount, he kind of talked around it. So, you know, that and the I'll go wherever my heart goes, you know, that your heart is led by, a lot of times in these situations, a player's heart is led by who makes the better offer. You know, you kind of said it. You know, yeah, he feels, so-and-so will feel in his heart that maybe I should take this nine-figure offer or whatever. I mean, gee whiz. It's been said that Pablo is using Hunter Pence's deal that he got at the end of the 2013 season as kind of a benchmark. Now, you look at Hunter's numbers, they exceed Pablo's, but it's all about supply and demand. There aren't a whole lot of good, solid third basemen available in free agency. Pablo is, that's a large reason, and he's a proven postseason performer. Those are large reasons why he may end up getting overpaid by whoever signs him, but that's just the way it's going to be.
Yeah, I saw that interesting. If there's really not a lot coming through the system and there's kind of a dearth of good third base options in free agency, he's definitely negotiating from a strong hand. And, the not-so-little-known secret is that there's also, Players Association puts a lot of pressure on these guys to go for the highest dollar and not so much, where they actually want to end up. Sometimes it works out for the players, and then other times, they're in the completely wrong place. And, I always find that unfortunate, but we'll keep our eye on him. Let's move on to Jake Peavy. So this is like a tale of two seasons. He comes to the Giants in a trade, and he basically helps them get to the postseason. Without him, they wouldn't have gotten there. So he wins like six of his last seven starts. But then he has this like really not good postseason. I think he's approaching his mid-30s if he's not there already. And, you're kind of looking at, what happens with him? Do you think that the Giants will have a great interest in him?
I think, Allison, they'll have some interest in him, but I believe he and Tim Hudson kind of gave maybe unfortunately a preview of coming attractions in the postseason. But let's face it, I don't know how much they have left. They're both fine performers, excellent, superb competitors, but at some point you got to have a little stuff. I don't know how much longer they can trick hitters. I don't mean to lump Hudson with Petey, but I guess I kind of am. And so as far as Jake goes, because Hudson is signed for one more year, regarding Jake, I think maybe the Giants will, look into making him some sort of offer, but if it's anything that's really exorbitant, I don't think they'll close a deal. There was something happened last week where I guess, Jake talks a lot, and he said something to the effect of he and John Lester going to the Cubs as a package deal, which, of course, that raised some red flags, with the people who, watch out for collusion violations. Yes, so tampering or whatever. So Jake hasn't said anything nearly to that effect, since then. So I think he's keeping his mouth shut. But again, I wouldn't be surprised if he too goes for the top dollar. It just might not be in San Francisco.
Yeah, it's interesting because, when we look at the way that the Giants ended the postseason, really just having like one horse in their rotation, other guys obviously performed well at particular times. Everyone was talking about Game 7 being so epic. I found it to be very disappointing that the starting pitchers weren't good on either side, and I just find that to be very anti-Game 7, but whatever, I'm over it. When you look at the rotation as a whole, going into next year, you really can't look at it and say, we don't really need to do a lot. We don't need to make a lot of tweaks because they do sort of need to redo the entire thing, but really kind of restock it, I guess. So, and Matt Cain, where does he fit in with that? When is he projected to be coming back?
Well, they're hoping, Allison, that he can come back as strong as he was before his bone chips and bone spurs start bothering him. that's saying a whole lot. I don't know. You know, I don't know how well people come back from this, whether it's like coming back from, you know, just a normal cut. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he loses some velocity, but maybe he comes back stronger. Who knows? I just don't know how these things go. He's supposed to start throwing in January. He's on schedule to come back in spring training. If he can come back and be even close to the pitcher he was before his elbow started bothering him, well, then that's almost like picking up a free agent. So, although, for his contract, nothing's free about it. But that would be a big asset. Because, as you said, right now, their starting rotation is probably one deep, and that's Bumgarner. And other than that, you know, it's a bunch of number five guys, whether they're signed or not signed. Hudson Petey, Vogelsong, and we don't know what's going to happen with Tim Lincecum, although it's pretty easy to assume that he'll go back in a starting rotation. But, you know, if he's going to be inconsistent again, it's almost, it's a wash with him. So right before he got demoted to the bullpen, he actually had a stretch of four straight decent starts where everybody thought, well, he's really turned it around. Well, he hadn't turned it around. So he'll get another chance too next year, but I think, you know, I think the Giants would be behooved to try and get themselves a, you know, solid number two or number three or even 1A guy, you know, to help the rotation. And again, this is nothing based on anything I've heard. You know, go after Scherzer. Go after James Shields, you know, if they really want to stay on top, you know.
So basically what you're saying is the World Series champions need to get a number two, number three, and number four starter.
Oh, yeah, it's funny. They don't, and then in the short series, Allison, that stuff doesn't hurt you. They were able to get past it. In 2010 and 2012, yeah, they needed that starting pitching, and that starting pitching carried them to the World Series titles in those years. This year was just, you know, they scratched by, and they got good enough starting pitching, or the relievers were able to take over before the damage was done, so to speak. It just so happened in Game 7 that reliever was Bumgarner, which is still, you know, boggling the mind, I think, of Giants fans and the Giants alike.
Yeah, it was something to watch for sure. So as far as it's still really early, and obviously the Giants have been playing until 7 days ago. So, but like an estimated payroll, I mean, are they expected to be around the same? They have lots of arbitration eligibles coming up, so that, you know, you factor in a huge chunk of the payroll to that. Do you get any impression that, I mean, they can't really say that they're going to scale back after what they just, you know, accomplished. Do you see them kind of being around where they usually are payroll-wise?
Yeah, they'll get a bump. It'll go up because it always does. They have to add. Again, it sounds so funny to throw these figures around in such a cavalier manner, but they may have to go up with another $10 million, $20 million, something like that. Especially if they sign a, you know, decent free agent, you know, to help the rotation, or if they have to replace Pablo at third base. But they've proven they'll do what they have to do. So exactly where, I don't think they're going to get to the luxury tax level, but they may come close.
Yeah, I always wonder, because it's such an interesting study. I mean, historically, when a team wins a World Series, it's nearly impossible to repeat it the next year. I mean, it's, you know, you're talking about a few exceptions, like the Yankees when they had their dynasty going, and it's happened a couple times in history, the A's, the Blue Jays. But for the most part, if you keep the core group, if you keep the same cast of characters together largely without making that many changes, it usually doesn't work next year. You know, the guys that had career years don't come back and have the same kind of year. Arms, you know, the pitcher's arms are another, you know, 250 innings in, and they're not quite as effective. So, I mean, it is kind of interesting. It's almost not a terrible thing that the Giants have to sort of redo their rotation in some ways, because you really can't have the exact same group coming back. Or, you know, they might not be able to do the same thing next year.
Yeah. One thing that's been a hallmark of the organization is continuity from top to bottom, from whether it's the front office, players, or, you know, even like the clubhouse people. They've enjoyed a lot of continuity. That is what has helped make them what they are, a three-time World Series winner in a stretch of five seasons. And, yeah, they'll I mean, again, if Kane and Lindstrom come back, they'll, you know, come back strong. Well, then maybe their rotation is still pretty good. But I think they'll take a shot at signing Vogelsong because, you know, despite his numbers, Bruce Bochy believes, and I can concur because I saw most of his starts this year, he suffered from bad luck. But, you know, that luck better even out for him next year if that's going to happen. So the situation may not be dire, but it is something they'll have to address. Whereas in previous seasons, they could just almost take for granted the starting pitching.
So I'll ask you, because people have asked me, and what do I know? Is this a dynasty? Are we in the middle of a Giants dynasty?
I guess by today's standards, it is a dynasty. You have so much parity in baseball. Three titles in 5 years. Boy, you know, it's hard to argue with that. I think sometimes, Allison, these things are best viewed, and I'm not trying to cop out on your question, but best viewed in retrospect. You know, let's see who makes the Hall of Fame. It's almost like presidential administrations. You know, was so-and-so a good president? Well, history decides that, you know, 20, 10, 20, even 30 years down the road. You know, they're only the second. I think one thing you can say right now is that they're pretty darn good. I mean, they're only the second National League team ever to win three World Series in 5 years. So that says a lot right now. Bruce Bochy is probably going to the Hall of Fame. Buster Posey, you know, borderline Hall of Fame candidate. I think you can project him as. Bumgarner, you know, he may, barring injury, you know, knock on wood, he may end up winning 200 games in his career, and that's, you know, that's a huge number at this stage, you know, the way, you know, in the year of the five-man rotation. So, you know, maybe two superb players, the rest, you know, very good players. I guess, I think history will judge, but there are certain things you can say now, and that is that, the organization runs things and the players compete, you know, better than, significantly better than their peers.
Yeah, it's just weird that the other years they weren't even in the playoffs, but that's why people are asking the question. So, well, thank you, Chris. And while I thought that we weren't going to be talking to you again for a while, it looks like we're going to. So we'll be checking back with you as the winter meetings approach. So thanks a lot. Get some rest. I'm here with the beat writer for the Padres for MLB.com, Corey Brock. And now that the season is over, October is over, and we are a few weeks away from the winter meetings, the focus shifts to the hot stove season, so which is always fun for the fans and not so much for the media because sometimes it gets a little busier than sometimes during the season. But there's a lot going on with every team, even the teams that did not make the playoffs in 2014. So Corey, let's talk about the Padres a little bit. Talking about their needs heading into the off season, you have a new general manager and he's had a lot of work to do and just kind of shaping his front office and getting all that in order. And now he is looking toward what to do with the team on the field in 2015. So you had mentioned that offense is really kind of the greatest need right now. And how do you see them sort of shoring that up?
Yeah, Allison, needs aplenty. I think that's that best describes the Padres' mantra going into the offseason. Yeah, I think A.J. Preller, the first-year general manager, hired in August, gave him some time to, you know, evaluate what the Padres had, what they didn't have, give them a chance to make some important hires in the front office, give them a chance to get his feet on the ground, get some policies in place, and sort of get everything lined up for what should be a busy offseason. I think you don't have to be an ardent or a serious Padre fan to understand that the top of the wish list is going to be offense. This is a team that reached some pretty historic lows in terms of run scoring in 2014. They were shut out 19 times. You know, they still won 77 games, which is a real testament, I think, to, you know, their pitching staff, the coaching staff, manager Bud Black, pitching coach Darren Balsley. that this team didn't fall completely flat, given how the monumental struggles they really had offensively. So I think that, you know, they're going to go out and they're going to look to make some improvements. And, you know, the Padres are certainly a team that's not hasn't traditionally spent a lot in free agency. So I would expect that they would look to trade and look for improvements through trades and maybe some non-tenders from some other teams and look for some gems that way. But I would think that the trade market where would be the area that A.J. Preller would probably look to improve this team first and foremost.
And so specifically, at what positions do you think that there needs to be some upgrades?
Yeah, I think the corner infield spots, first and third base, you know, which are traditional power spots. The Padres didn't get a whole lot of production out of those spots last season. They needed to make a determination on what they're going to get from Everett Cabrera at shortstop last year. And, you know, he was an all-star in 2013, you know, really struggled last year, had some injury issues. His 272 on base percentage doesn't cut it at the top of the order or really even the bottom of the order. So you need to decide if he's going to be a part of your mix moving forward. They have four outfielders under contract for next year, but, you know, I don't know if all four fit in their plans. Is Carlos Quinn, is he going to be healthy? What are you going to get from him? So there's a lot of question marks. They do have some trade assets. You know, ideally trading an asset to gain an asset isn't a great scenario, but I think that's the Padres. That's their reality at this point. They have some pitching they could part with. Andrew Cashner could be a guy they moved. Tyson Ross had a big year. He was an all-star. I think he would command the biggest return in a deal. So there's some interesting decisions awaiting A.J. Preller. And here's the other thing, Allison, that we don't know. You know, at least with, you know, like Josh Burns and, you know, his predecessor, Jed Hoyer, but more or less, you know, Kevin Towers before that, you have some sort of sample size in terms of trade history, or you understand exactly how they operate. We have no idea what A.J. Preller wants to do here, and he's been very tight-lipped. Certainly he's made a mark internationally, and I know he's been scouring the earth, and that's I'm not being glib there. I mean, they've really been traveling the globe here looking for some talent on the international market, whether that be in the Pacific Rim, Latin America, or elsewhere. So, you know, there could be some moves made there. So it's going to be interesting to see how he goes about trying to improve this team, address some big needs in his first offseason.
So when you look at the Padres, I mean, of course, you know, everyone has optimism and hope going into spring training and everybody wants to be a contender. But, I mean, you say that, yeah, there is trade bait on the major league level, but it's sometimes, you know, odd to trade something, like you said, trade major league talent to get major league talent. I mean, are they sort of like, I mean, I guess every team kind of wants to fit that model of developing their own talent. I mean, and the Padres are certainly in a situation where they need to. I mean, that's how they're going. If they're going to have a winning formula, it's going to have to come from within, because the finances dictate that for most of the teams. When do you see them? I mean, you know the farm system better than anybody. I mean, do you see something coming together in a few years? Like, I mean, realistically, like, how long would it take for the Padres to really be contenders?
Yeah, they have some interesting pieces on the way. They have some pitching down on the farm. They have a very strong defensive-minded catcher who had a rough year in the Texas League, which is a pitcher's league anyway. Austin Hedges, who earned rave reviews from Brad Ausmus, you know, who worked in the Padres front office before taking a job with the managing job with the Tigers. He's still young. I think, you know, this is a guy that's going to catch in the big leagues for a long time. We'll have to see what his offense is going to be. And then the guy that's really had a big fall, Allison, in the Arizona Fall League, Hunter Renfro, the first-round draft pick from a couple of years ago. And I would encourage fans to go to Padres.com and dig up the video of him hitting this tape-measure home run that I think landed in New Mexico the other day. Just an absolute bomb he hit in a game. And this is a guy that maybe, you know, it's got this high upside power, has a big arm, can run pretty well. You know, this is an organization that, you know, for whatever reason has had trouble drafting and developing and getting impact players to the big leagues in the last decade or so. They've done a good job of getting some players to the big leagues, but in terms of impact players, they've really struggled there, and that's shown when you look at their major league roster. And I think that gets overlooked a little bit, but I think this could be a guy that fans can maybe finally wrap their arms around as a guy, you know, that could make some waves once he gets to the big leagues. Now, he's maybe a year or two away, but he's put on a very big show in the Arizona Fall League. I think he's gotten on a lot of people's radar. So, yeah, there's some help coming. There's some help on the way. And as you know, Allison, these guys in the minor leagues, these prospects, serve many, many purposes for you. They can not only help you at the big league level, that's ideal, but they can also serve as pieces that you can move in deals to get you something in return. The Padres haven't had that, so they've always kind of been working from a deficit in that regard, but it's starting to get better.
Exactly, and that's the thing that you have to keep kind of reminding fans about is that it doesn't, like, people are so worried about, oh my God, there's, what are we going to, if this guy can play second base, but they already have this guy coming to the system that can play second base. And it's like, no, you never can have too much depth, and so much of that depth is used to strengthen your major league roster through trades. And I also just think that, I mean, when it comes to some of these teams that that need to develop, like you say, that they haven't really, like, drafted and developed an impact player in so long. And you know, I heard a lot of, like, small market teams sort of complaining about how the new draft rules are set up, that they feel like they're at a little bit of a disadvantage because that's where they would just spend, overspend. They couldn't overspend in free agency, but they could overspend on draft picks. And at the same time, I feel like, and I mean, I do come at this from an Astros perspective where, you know, their unsignable section on draft day was enormous. And I just felt like, I feel like with the new draft rules in place, that there just aren't that many unsignable because there's just a specific amount that you can spend. And I kind of feel like teams like the Padres might, over time, like in 10 more years, we may look back and say, well, they've drafted some pretty good impact players because they just, the funding just seemed to be a little more equal. Or do you see where I'm coming from, or do you think that's kind of skewed?
No, I think especially with the way the new system's set up now, I think it's meant to kind of level the playing field, for lack of a better term. And I think teams like the Padres and teams, that traditionally the lower market teams can make some headway there in the draft. But you have the system in place and these rules in place. However, it's still incumbent upon you as an organization. And you and as your baseball operations staff and your scouts and your cross-checkers to still put in the time and do the work and get to know these players and, you know, really beat the bushes and find the right ones and draft them and then get them, hand them over to your player development staff. It's such an interesting and such a long, long winding road for these guys, Allison. You know, like what do they tell you, like with these high school kids, you have to give them 5 years before you truly understand what you have in them. And okay. You know, college kids certainly don't need that much time. And it's so much different than the other professional sports drafts. It's, you know, and I could see where people maybe get a little impatient with it and you're trying to project talent. I find the whole process to be completely fascinating. I love the draft. I think it's great. You know, you're kind of wishing on a star a little bit with some of these guys, but I think that's kind of the fun part. And the guys who are really good at it, man, those are the guys that stay employed for a long time and make a really good living doing it. But it's a difficult thing trying to project talent. What this skinny 18-year-old is going to be when he's 23, 24 years old. And I mean, that's why we see some of these guys slip so far, you know, 29th round draft pick or, you know, the Padres had this kid, Brad Brock, who's now a reliever with the Orioles. Maybe saw him in the AL playoffs there. You know, he was in the 40th round, and that wasn't a draft and follow. You know, this was just a guy that pitched at like a small D1 school in upstate New York, and you know they liked his arm. You know, they weren't sure what was going to become of him, but he was a 40th round draft pick. Let's take a chance on him. Maybe he could evolve into something. Well, he did. He became a big leaguer. And at what expense? I mean, it probably cost you a bus ticket, you know? So, I don't know. I could talk about the draft all day, Allison. But I think the system is good. I think it's fair. But it's still up to these teams to make something of it.
And the fact that only 5% of any guy drafted gets to the big leagues is just a shocking percentage, but that's the way it works in our game. I saw that the Padres may have about upwards of $30 million owed to players that are arbitration eligible, assuming that they would just have, you know, a similar roster coming back. Is that a concern? Is that, do you see that as a large number, a workable number? Does that fit the budget?
Yeah, I think just kind of the way with service time and how it all kind of shook out. I think there's some guys in line for some decent raises. In particular, on the pitching side, Ian Kennedy, who had a very nice year, he's gonna make, you know, an upwards of $10 million. And I think the number I saw the Major League Baseball trade rumors was projecting as a group maybe $30 million with the entire group. So, yeah, the Padres have their work cut out for them in terms of, you know, I don't think they'll go to the teams hate going to arbitration with guys. It's such a, such an ugly process, or potentially ugly process, I should say, when you're trying to sit across the table from a guy and haggle about his shortcomings, and then the next day you're out there in spring training patting him on the back and saying, no hard feelings, go get him. So it's, I think it's kind of normal. And I think in some cases, I think like with Tyson Ross, with Andrew Kastner and Ian Kennedy, all the guys that are arbitration eligible and due for some raises, I think they're well-deserved raises. First of all, three of those guys pitched well last year. Those three guys, not all of them, but I think the potential for some contract extensions, maybe with one of them, maybe with two of them. We'll have to see moving forward for this team to maybe lock up one of those guys. Ross would seem to be a likely candidate, especially with the upside that he has and the improvements he's made since they traded for him a couple years ago from the A's, and like I said, developed into an all-star this year. And in my mind, maybe one of the best pitchers in the National League, kind of flew under the radar a little bit. And the win-loss record's a little deceiving, and we really shouldn't look at that anyway in terms of performance, because so many other factors determine that. But he was dominant this year. And Andrew Kastner, the pride of Conroe, Texas, I think when he's been healthy, he's been very dominating as well. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see where that final figure ends up. But the Padres roughly owe guys on their roster right now about $41 million, and then you throw in the projected, 30 or so million, that gets you to about 70. Payroll last year was about 90. I would expect that goes up a little bit. That's just my own guess. So there's some room there. We'll see what they do with it, though.
Amazing. And a $90 million payroll can be toward the bottom of the league, but that is the world we live in. So. Corey, thank you very much. I think we'll be checking in with you this off season. So thanks for your time. We'll be talking to you soon. I am joined by the Rockies beat writer, Thomas Harding, and we are going to start talking a little hot stove action now that the postseason is over and we're heading toward the winter meetings. So regardless of how teams fared in the regular season or whether they got to the postseason, The hot stove season is for everybody, and it can be very action-packed. So, Thomas, let's just get right off the bat here. I think that what everyone's talking about, and I know that the Troy Tulowitzki, Carlos Gonzalez saga has carried on through the season, but it seems that maybe the owner has been swayed to at least maybe listen to possible offers that would move either one of those players. So that's sort of a more recent revelation. What did you think about that? I know you've talked a lot about how it's probably, it would be a long shot. They've been very hesitant to even talk about it. Do you see this as kind of a tide turning in that respect?
I don't see much of a tide turn, to be honest with you. I don't think it's changed from the position that they would have to be blown away by the offer, get full value for these guys, and I don't see full value out there for them to be, especially coming off having season-ending surgery in August. That's really a huge question. I think that the guy that's more likely to be dealt is Justin Morneau, who's coming off of a full and healthy season and a very productive one. He won the NL batting title and was a finalist for the Gold Glove Award. I really believe that there may be the deal out there to get pitching in the form of Justin Morneau. Here's the issue, is that they gave Michael Kodire the $15.3 million qualifying offer, really hoping he'll take it. If he takes that, then you can make another trade, whether it's Cargo or Tulo, or, as I say, it is more likely, whether it's Morneau, to try to get several pitching pieces, which is what they need. They don't want to blow this thing up because they really believe they're close, and it's hard for me to see them trading Carlos Gonzalez, who is a really good defender in right field, which makes a huge difference, or Troy Tulowitzki from the shortstop position and still feeling like they're close to winning.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that there's a lot of gamesmanship that sort of goes on this time of year. I mean, you know, strategically leaking things to the media when it's, you know, works in the team's favor. I mean, that's been going on since the beginning of time. And there's nothing wrong with exploring the options. I mean, for, you know, everybody's name is out there. I try to, you know, people get a little bit worked up throughout the off season when they hear, you know, the teams talked about this player, and it's like everybody's talking about everybody. It's kind of like in August, everybody's put on waivers and everyone freaks out when one of those names leaks out. So I don't know. I guess when it comes to, you know, reports on that, I mean, it wouldn't hurt the Rockies to at least like throw it out there and just to see, you know, what they might be offered in return.
Yeah, I don't think it would hurt them to see what's out there for those guys. And really, you go back to as far as the winter meetings in 2011 when Dan O'Dowd was still in charge of it, and they decided to start taking a more fresh look at their roster, saying, we're not going to show up at the winter meetings and say anybody is off limits. Let's look at everything and see what happens. And I believe that under new GM Jeff Breidich, that's kind of where the Rockies are. You know, they'll listen to people when they call. Listen, Breidich just put together his front office 2 days ago. So the idea that there's anything imminent is a little premature, but Michael Kadire has until Monday to accept or reject the qualifying offer. And once that happens, whether he takes it or not, that's when I think that the Rockies will be in business looking to see what they could do to try to improve their starting pitching.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the dynamic of the front office now that it's all been kind of settled in and the roles have been a little bit more defined. But what's your take on all that? I mean, it's been sort of a turbulent, you know, year or so, and you hear, you know, a lot of things that just come out. There was, you know, some unrest, a lot of, you know, just it seemed to be a little bit fractured. You see it kind of all coming together now. I mean, what's your take on Breidich and sort of the staff that he's put together?
I really believe that it could come together because there were some very good people in that front office for the Rockies, but the idea at the top to essentially have a two-headed general manager with the owner making the final decision, I think that drowned out a lot of very good ideas in there. And that was one of the reasons why they didn't want to blow up their organization and go on the outside. And they still like the roster. They still think something could happen with this roster if you put better pitching with it. So by streamlining the decision-making, and what a lot of people with the Rockies hope is that Jeff Breidich and his crew make the decisions. You know, obviously the owner gets involved when it's a really big ticket item, but if Breidich and that crew there that's involved, they have a lot of good information people, a lot of good analysis people, and some scouts that have poured over other organizations simply because of all the trade rumors. If they're able to do their jobs, I think that they could put together a decent roster going into next year. And it all leads to this, Allison, is that they believe that this may be the last shot with this roster, with Cargo and Tulo and the parts that they have to try to win a championship or contend and make the playoffs. If they don't, or if they're where they have been at midseason, then I would really more at that time expect Tulo and Cargo and guys like that to be dealt where they're shedding money and trying to rethink their organization.
Wow. So looking at 2015, I mean, from, you know, looking from the outside, I mean, just from an objective standpoint, I mean, you think that they can be competitive in that division as soon as next season?
If you look before the injuries, especially the injuries to the starting rotation well into May, they were second in the division. They were competing. And if you look at even other years with the offensive roster they have, that's good enough to compete. The question is, can they get enough starting pitching to make a difference? You go back to the 2010 season, they had really good starting pitching. The 2009 season when they made the playoffs. And even in 10 before the injuries at the end of the season, they had pretty good starting pitching, and they got the wild card in 2009. You go back to 2007, the starting pitching actually wasn't as good, but they had so much depth in the system that they could call up guys who helped them at that time, like Ubaldo Jimenez and Franklin Morales. They actually made a difference because they lost three of their five starting pitchers in August. So if they have enough pitching depth and they don't get it all hurt at once and maybe just add some to the quality of it, and that's the key, is getting quality starting pitching, then you put I put that lineup against a whole lot of others, and I think that that's kind of the attitude that the Rockies have. I know that's the attitude that Walt Weiss has. He really believes that the lineup is good enough to contend if he has decent pitching, which is why the last season was so frustrating, especially from his point of view, because he watched a pretty good lineup, all the guys get hurt, and then all the pitching get hurt, and it was a horrible season. And it's hard to stomach a season like that when you believe in the talent that you have.
Right. And I mean, the biggest, like you say, the starting pitching is obviously the biggest need. And do you see them being players on a free agent market? Do you think that they are just looking from within? Can they make some trades? I mean, do they have payroll restrictions? Like, what's going on with all of that?
Well, you go back to the decision to extend Kadire the offer, because if you extend him the offer and he takes it, then you know he's a pretty good first baseman there. So you have Justin Morneau, who is a very good first baseman offensively and defensively. Obviously, he's far better than Kadire defensively. But certainly, with the lineup they have, you could trade a Justin Morneau for pitching, possibly multiple pitching parts. I mean, he's making $6.75 next year with a $750,000 buyout. You figure that if you get that amount of pitching in return, or you get back some young pitching, maybe guys who are just breaking in, and then use some of the other money for a low-cost veteran, then you could build your pitching that way. So it would be trades first. And they also have a catcher, Willene Rosario, who looks like an American League-type player. You could move him there. There's been talk about even Drew Stubbs being moved, although I don't think necessarily they would do that right now until looking at a Morneau deal. But they have some parts you can trade for starting pitching, and it's a lot easier to trade for it than sign it on the free agent market, simply because a lot of the top pitchers don't want to pitch here, or they charge more to pitch here.
Right. Yeah, you wonder. I mean, that's always going to be a stigma that goes along with that, and it's kind of unfortunate. But I guess for as long as the Colorado Rockies exist, that's going to be the issue, is just luring the free agents there. And even though there's been guys that have been very successful and have settled in nicely and have really, crushed all the theories that you can't really pitch successfully there. But, baseball players tend to be a little bit sensitive, and so, or maybe a little bit paranoid, and I guess that's just always going to be something that follows them.
Well, if you look at it, when you have a choice, then a lot of times you're not going to pitch at Coors Field. So here's the question: if you have the choice, and the Colorado Rockies come, if you're a top-notch pitcher, you know that other teams are going to offer you more money, so that makes the choice for you. If the Rockies want to compete with them, then the pitcher says, well, I need a little bit more because I'm going to take a beating pitching at Coors Field, so it becomes even more cost prohibitive. One of the best ways to do it, if you're going to go in the free agent market, is to find someone who's trying to rebuild his value, like this year, a Justin Masterson or somebody like that, who maybe didn't have the year that he wanted to have and isn't getting the contract he wants. Maybe you can compete in that particular market, bring him in for a year, let him pitch and pitch his way out of it. I mean, it happened several – it's been a while, but it happened with Darren Oliver. It really saved his career. And also Sean Estes got a few more productive seasons after coming to Colorado for a year. So it can happen. It's just when you get into the market and pitchers have – other choices, there are teams that offer more money and teams that offer a better home field to pitch in. So that's why it's hard to attract free agents.
And so looking toward next year, I was kind of reading some of your coverage. I mean, I guess Charlie Blackmon seems to be somebody to sort of watch. He's an interesting guy who he had kind of an up and down season, but was very impressive for much of it. And I guess, is that a question going into next year? Like, exactly what can they expect to sort of get out of him?
I think they're expecting a pretty good year out of him, considering that they converted him to a leadoff hitter. He really wasn't one. And with all the ups and downs, I do think that he learned, and he finished pretty strong. He had obviously a beginning that you couldn't sustain. It was so effective. And then he struggled in the middle of the year, almost to a point to where you're wondering if this is going to be one of those guys that fell off the map. But by season's end, he was hitting the ball pretty well. And, another guy they brought in this year into more of a full-time role was Corey Dickerson. And Corey Dickerson, who looks to be the starting left fielder next year, very good hitter, not as great a defender, but, you know, those are a couple of guys that you can build on. Or if you really want to get creative, they're guys who don't make a whole lot of money who maybe could help somebody else if you really wanted to include them in a big trade and retool that way. As long as you keep your nucleus here, if you really believe that you could be a winning team, keep your nucleus together and see what you can build around it.
Okay, well, you've got me convinced that they're going to be wild card contenders next year. So I'm jumping on board. I am jumping on board now that I have had this conversation with you.
Yeah, I'll be honest. When you look at the record, and then you look at the names on the roster and their just pedigree here, this is not a 90-some loss team. I mean, and frankly, that's why nationally you look and it's the Rockies. They're not very good. But really here locally with the media and the fans, it's like there is no excuse not to be competing at the top of that division. I mean, I believe they won the season series with the Giants. They played well at AT&T Park. That's the difference here is that record aside, there are a lot of people who look at this team and say, why aren't they winning? Why haven't they won by now? And that's the attitude that's coming from the management team that's running.
Okay, well, we'll keep our eyes out for them. And, Thomas, thank you. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks. Appreciate it. I am joined by my intrepid colleague, Steve Gilbert, who covers the Diamondbacks for MLB.com. And, Steve, we are at that point in the season where the regular season is over, the playoffs are over, and now we are all looking toward the winter meetings and just the offseason in general to see, you know, which teams are going to be active and how teams are going to shore up their teams for next season. So hot stove action is in full gear. And let's talk a little bit about the Diamondbacks. It seems like it's sort of a wait and see sort of situation with them where they don't have any, you know, pressing free agent situations to address. But at the same time, the starting pitching class seems to be something that they might not be tapping into this year. So how do you see sort of where the Diamondbacks are starting right now? What are they thinking?
Yeah, you know, Allison, it's kind of fascinating, too, because this is the first time we're seeing Tony La Russa in his new role as, you know, leading the front office during an offseason. And it's Dave Stewart's first go-around as a general manager, so we're not really sure how he's going to approach, you know, the offseason. Usually with Kevin Towers, we knew that he was going to be aggressive and be out there and take chances. I'm not sure what we're going to see out of Dave Stewart, but, you know, you're right. They are looking to try to beef up their rotation a bit. But it's tough because they don't have a ton of financial flexibility to play on some of the bigger name free agents that are out there. So maybe it's possible they could work out some kind of a trade to do that. You know, they have a limited amount of chips, I think, because I don't think they'll be trying to part with any one of their really young players. But I think maybe you could see a guy like Miguel Montero possibly go in a trade for a starting pitcher if it's the right one. That could be their really kind of big chip that they use this offseason.
And it would be more of an enticement. I mean, I know that they're a little too stocked at the middle infielders at shortstop, but do you think that there would be anything, a combination of anything there that could net, like a pitcher that would be even worth trading for?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure how they're going to try to work this because they also have some payroll concerns. They had a record high payroll last year at $110 million, so that's something that certainly can go much higher than that, and probably is going to go quite a bit lower than that. So, in his first off season as a general manager, Dave Stewart's going to have to. Be pretty creative if he wants to improve this team significantly.
And plus, I would think that it's almost tempting. I mean, well, yeah, I mean, they don't have a lot of funds available. There's not much, you know, flexibility there. But, I mean, we've talked about it all through the second half of the season since we started doing these podcasts that, you know, the Diamondbacks are one of those many teams that really were decimated by injuries and it could actually be pretty decent next year if you can get some of these key guys back, especially on the pitching side. But and so are they looking more to just look at a healthy return more than they're like, okay, wow, look at this, you know, 64-98 record. we've got to make, you know, wholesale changes. It looks like more like they're just going to be like, okay, everybody just put Band-Aids on it and heal, and we'll talk to you at spring training.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really good point, too, is they're banking on the fact that, you know, they're going to get Patrick Corbin back, if not for the start of the regular season next year, at least, you know, early in the season. They're also going to get Paul Goldschmidt back. A.J. Pollock is going to be healthy and ready to go from the start of the year. David Hernandez, one of the top relievers, should be ready to go from the start of the year. So, I mean, all these injury issues that they had should be taken care of, and that should help them improve in that way. And then if they're able to make a few changes around the edges and some improvements here or there and get some development of their young players, then maybe they can take that step forward without necessarily having to make any big kind of off-season type acquisition.
So from a prospect standpoint, I mean, there's always, you know, there's one or two guys everybody's looking at to maybe crack the up-any-day roster. What are you looking for the Diamondbacks prospects and how, you know, I mean, it's way too early to determine who's going to get invites to spring training and who's really going to be, you know, serious contenders. But, I mean, who would – there are a couple guys that stand out that could be truly knocking on the door once spring training convenes.
Sure, you know, I think Archie Bradley is one of the guys that you always kind of have your eye on. He's a top pitching prospect, and going into last year, he was ranked as a top pitching prospect in all of baseball by MLB.com. So he's somebody that they definitely would like to see step forward into the rotation. They've got some of the younger pitchers that contributed this past year, like a Chase Anderson or maybe an Andrew Chafin, that could also step forward. That would be helpful to them. And also what would also be really helpful to Allison is if they could finally figure out Trevor Cahill and get him back to at least being a serviceable pitcher, because he's somebody they're paying a lot of money to, and they could desperately need innings from starting pitchers, and he would be somebody that if they could just get him back to where he was a couple of years ago, they would be really thrilled with that.
So I'm intrigued by we were actually just talking to Tim Gernick from the Dodgers, and we were marveling about how there's like four or five general managers who are now comprising the front office staff, you know, former guys that are being brought into the fold. And I'm very intrigued by Tony La Russa, sort of an administrator, you know, a guy that spent his entire career as a manager. Obviously, he's in the Hall of Fame. But, I mean, this is such a different thing for him. And if there's anybody that knows, you know, would know his place, I would think it would be La Russa. So I can't see any conflict there. But, I mean, just what do you see overall, just observations on his kind of administrative skills and sort of being the boss and not being on the field? Has that been an easy transition for him? Has it been a weird transition? Do you think it's strange for him at all, a feeling still to not really be in that dugout?
I think when you talk to people who have dealt with him over this past year, they come back to Tony's so bright that he understands what it is that he doesn't understand, and so he's able to ask questions and you know, tries to rely on others that have experience. He talked a lot about how he learned a lot from Kevin Towers, just kind of about how the front office works and what goes on, what goes into a trade deadline. That was the first time he'd ever been in a you know, the war room, so to speak, for a trade deadline. It's the first time he'd ever been in the draft room, really, for the whole draft preparation situation. So it's been a tremendous learning experience for him in that way. And I think he's done a decent job of staying out of the way of the manager. And that was one of the things that he made clear when he hired Chip Hale, was that, you know, he's not going to micromanage Chip. He's not going to try to dictate strategy on the field. And in fact, even after games, it'll be Dave Stewart, if anybody goes down into Chip's office to kind of, you know, debrief after a game, it's not going to be Tony, it would be Dave Stewart. And Tony would be available, of course, if Chip wanted anything or needed anything, but it was not going to be looking over his shoulder and talking to players and doing things like that. So he understands the importance of letting a manager do what a manager does and not have a lot of interference from the front office.
When you look at overall, just a realistic, I've been kind of asking, you know, the reporters to give me a realistic prognostication about, you know, when we could see some of the teams that were not contenders last year, when they can really be jumping into the fold. I mean, would you say that the Diamondbacks, You know, are they, I mean, like the Rockies, I mean, Thomas Harding certainly thinks that the Rockies, if healthy, could contend for the wild card next year. I mean, how do you see the Diamondbacks shaping up over the next year or 2 years?
I mean, if they get back to being healthy and they get some development from some of their key young players, like, say, an Archie Bradley, if, you know, Jake Lamb at third base turns out to be a pretty good hitter, I think you can make a case that, yeah, they could be in that contention for a wild card or if everything breaks right, a division. But certainly they need things to go right for them, and they need, for certain people to step up, like I mentioned earlier, like a Trevor Cahill or Patrick Corbin to come back and be healthy. So, I don't think that they're as bad a team as their record indicated last year. I think they got off to a horrible start. They had a lot of injuries, and it was just something that they could not dig their way out of. But I don't think it's a team that is that bad. I think it's a team that needs some help and needs some things to break their way, but could easily be a 500 or better team after that. And, you know, 88 wins or 85 wins puts you right in contention for that second wild card spot. So certainly I think anything's possible in the next couple of years for the Diamondbacks as far as that goes.
Yeah, that start that they had was historically bad. I mean, that's impossible. Even for the really, really good teams that are supposed to be playoff contenders, that's hard to dig out of, let alone a team that, you know, there were so many question marks around. So, all right, Steve, you take care of yourself. I'm not going to keep you any longer. But thank you very much, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Okay, sounds good, Allison. Thank you.
Visit the official online shop of Major League Baseball at MLB.com/shop for the largest selection of authentic caps, t-shirts, jerseys, hoodies, collectibles, and more. Get your gear straight from the source, the MLB.com shop.